Welcome to The Way Forward, Regenerative Conversation Podcast number 20. Overshoot and collapse. Is that what our future holds? Conversation with Jim Annis. I'm the producer, Jim Burke. On YouTube and in current books, stories of pending societal collapse are increasingly apparent. Are we just experiencing the reoccurrence of the age-old theme, the end is near? Or is something new happening? Are the increasing climate catastrophes, supply chain shortages, rising fuel and food prices caused by our growing environmental footprint? Are they symptoms of pending societal collapse? Are we in denial of this new abnormal? Drawing from the recent work of Jim Bendel, we explore his provocative new book, Breaking Together, A Freedom-Loving Response to Collapse. Our guest in this conversation is Jim Annis. Jim is an environmentalist, grandfather, musician, intellectual, and retired senior environmental policy analyst for the state of Washington. Jim comes to this conversation with a remarkable history of community service and activism. After attending Northwestern University School of Law in Chicago, he worked as a small-town lawyer for 6 years, where he represented anti-nuclear civil disobedience defendants, battered women, and a case for the ACLU. Most of his career, he worked for the Washington State Department of Ecology, focusing on toxic cleanup and shoreline management. He also worked with the Washington State Recreation and Conservation Office, where he helped create a compliance program for a state agency that bought the best pieces of land in the state and protected them forever. With a portfolio of over 9,000 grants valued at some $3 billion. Jim also helped create an intentional co-housing community about 15 years ago in Olympia, Washington, where he and his wife still live. He's also an avid hiker, reader, swimmer, piano player, and conversationalist. And now for our host, Dr. John Izu and Alain Gauthier.
Hi, I'm Dr. John Izzo, and on behalf of my co-host, Alain Gauthier, and our producer, Jim Burke, welcome to the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast, where we explore issues of concern for us individually and for society in terms of how we can create a regenerative present and a regenerative future for ourselves and for the world. So welcome. We're glad to have you here today. And Alain, I'm a bit daunted and nervous and excited about our topic today. And perhaps the best way to frame this topic is that today we're going to talk about the potential that it's too late to avoid some kind of significant collapse in society, especially for humans. And what should we do? In light of that, is it helpful to think that collapse is inevitable or pretty close to it? Because it turns out there are some pretty thoughtful people getting some pretty significant following around that thinking in a variety of ways. And it made me think of when my mother had cancer 6 years ago, and they told us pretty much there's nothing more that we can do. And then she entered what many of us in this virtual room have experienced, which is she entered hospice care. And we all may not know what the technical definition of hospice care is, but it's that time when we're no longer taking interventions to extend life. We've accepted that this person is going to die sometime soon, though we may not know when. And the goal is for that person to be comfortable and as pain-free as possible and to have whatever quality of life they can have, but we're no longer doing anything to try to save that person. And indeed, there are some really thoughtful people saying that we're in a time of hospice care now for humanity. And there's a particular book we're going to talk about today written by Jim Bendel called Breaking Together, A Freedom-Loving Response to Collapse. And I want to read just one quote from his book. It requires some courage to break a taboo around the high likelihood of climate-induced collapse as opposed to mere climate disruption. It takes some courage to make people aware of darkness that they had not seen before or had simply turned away from, especially when that darkness is not in the changing climate and the institutions that have damaged our world, but is also within us. Because we have all participated in both the creation of this disaster and the ignoring of it, or being satisfied with ineffectual action that provided us with a believable myth that by being a good person, we would be able to change things. As such, climate chaos is an invitation to go deeper into self-reflection and learn about not only why we have participated in such destruction, but to think about what we're going to do now that we know it's coming. And perhaps a little less dire, Meg Wheatley, who many of you are probably followers of, in her books, Who Do We Choose to Be?, talked about no matter what is going on around us, we can attend to the people in front of us, to the issues confronting us, and offer what we can. We can offer insight and compassion. We can be present. We can stay and not flee. We can be exemplars of the best human qualities. That is a well life lived, even if we didn't save the world. So that's an invitation today to have a conversation with Ilan and our guest, who Ilan will introduce in just a moment and bring into the conversation. So what do we make of this movement? Is it too late? Is it helpful to think it's too late? And what's the real message that Jem Bendel may be trying to bring across in his book, Breaking Together? So, Ilan, over to you. I'm looking forward to this conversation today.
So am I, John. And probably for me, the most interesting part of Jem Bendel's book, he says, collapse is not only inevitable, it has already started. We are probably 5 years into it. And so it's be a slow collapse, not just a one event. And I think it's really worth exploring that. As Meg Wheatley says, the main thing is to be able to face what is in front of us so that we can have the right answer. And because Jim Annis, inviting in this conversation, has a deep knowledge of Jem Bendel's book, we thought this would be good to have conversation between the three of us and see what we make of that and what opens up for listeners as they listen to us. So, Jim, we welcome you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your podcast. The first thing I want to say is that I'm a proud grandfather of four beautiful, creative children aged 4 months to 10 years. And for the record, I want to name them. They're Lucy, Brant, Gus, and Sam. I play with them every week. I watch them grow and develop and watch the world they're inheriting. And it frankly breaks my heart. So I say that to invite your listeners and you two as well to think about somebody in your life with whom you have a heartfelt connection to the future, because that's what this book is about. Yep. I guess the next thing I wanted to say, I practiced as a small town lawyer for 6 years. I love living in my small town, but I found the practice after a while to be no longer engaging the questions that most interested me or intellectually satisfying. And I decided what really interested me was intergenerational and interspecies justice, which is when I pivoted to go to work for the Department of Ecology. I helped create a co-housing community about 15 years ago. I got a federal grant to get us solar panels for some of our buildings. I drive a plug-in Prius. In short, I'm the very kind of person who Bendel says has been duped, has been ineffective in doing what needs to be done. So it's a very challenging book, but I think worth looking at.
We've all now read the book, Breaking Together, A Freedom-Loving Response to Collapse. And I think it would be interesting, perhaps, and starting with you, if each of us maybe talk briefly about what stood out for us from that book and what happened for us as we read it. And I think you read it a little longer ago than we did, so you may even have kind of made some changes, as I understand, in your life in part because of it. But let's start with you, and then Alana and I will also do the same. What did the book say to you, first of all, and how did you respond to it when you realized what the message was?
Well, let me start with just sort of three brief words, and maybe you guys would want to play that game as well, of sort of initial reactions to give people an overview. Three words for me are shocking, radical, and prophetic, in the sense of an old world prophet. But the three main messages I heard is that we've already begun, as Alon said, the early stages of collapse of the consumer industrial society. The second one is there's profound and nearly universal denial of this coming collapse. And third, and I think most important, that our best effort should now be focused on how we might nourish life, wisdom, and care in a time of disintegration and simplification.
Yes, and I read Jem Bendel's first book, which was actually co-authored with a number of writers, called Deep Adaptation. And in there, he was already advocating for getting not used to, but adjusted to what is really happening deep, even though we don't see yet the whole amplitude of what is happening, and to then cultivate some capacity for empathy, compassion for oneself and for people going through that, and knowing that it's going to require a lot more as we go and see some of the deeper aspects of the collapse at the societal level. That's what touched me in the book. He comes at it although he's an academic and has been an environmentalist for many years, recognized himself that he was actually duped in a number of steps that he took, environmentalist at the World Economic Forum, that he thought that we could probably do it, find a way to offset it and mitigate it. And he's changed his mind. So what I like the human aspect of his book is that I have been through that, and this is what I see now. And he has, of course, collected an amazing amount of facts. Actually, the first part of the book is mostly facts as to what is happening in the different spheres that are important, that are all interrelated, of course. And now everything comes together now. So that's what I appreciate. I appreciate the man looking at his own past evolution and seeing that it probably parallels what many of us, especially those of us who have been involved in trying to deal with mitigation of climate, say, well, that will not cut it. That will not be enough.
So my first response was that I thought he did an interesting job of, we tend to think of, especially people who are focused so much on climate, people tend to think that climate, if we just could reduce carbon emissions, everything will be fine. And I think what Bendel does very well in the book is he connects the various things that are happening, the collapse of the biosphere and various biosystems, the way we pretty much killed off nature, climate collapse, food collapse, energy collapse. So for those of you, for example, think that electric cars are going to save the future, read his chapter on the energy collapse, economic and monetary collapse. So the first thing is, I agree, he basically says, look, you all know these things are happening, but they're happening faster and more deeply and more profoundly than you think. And they're all coming together to create a converging, he would say, collapse for humanity as we know it. And it's very interesting. He does not say extinction, which I'm glad, because the people who think humans are going to go extinct short of an all-out nuclear war or an asteroid hitting the Earth are kidding themselves, because humans will claw and hang in for a long time, even if we're in smaller numbers. So he doesn't talk about extinction, but he says society as we know it, what we take for granted every day, getting up in the morning, going to Starbucks, plugging in our Tesla, taking a trip to Europe, all of this, he's saying, is going to come to an end, and we need to face it and smell the coffee. The second thing I got from him is basically he said, look, we've had a lot of well-intentioned efforts. I think it's unfair to say in the book, he says, like Alon, you kind of hinted at they were wrong. I actually feel what he was saying is it simply wasn't enough. It wasn't core enough. In other words, that it wasn't that all these things we are doing or think of doing aren't good, aren't even in the right direction. They're just not profound enough or deep enough to keep the collapse from happening. And here's where I might disagree with some people who read the book. At first, I thought he was a doomster, and he was saying, just like, live your life and get local and be kind and grow food. But I don't buy it. And here's what I mean by that. I think underneath the doomster, Jem Bendel is trying to issue a wake-up call. I actually don't think he thinks it's too late. I think what he's saying is it's too late unless we do something profoundly different than we're doing now. And he's saying, I don't have hope that we'll do that. But at the end of the day, I saw within the prophetic voice him sort of hoping that we'll still wake up and realize that the basic system has to be hacked and changed of the consumer-driven life that we're living. So I kind of reminds me years ago, someone, a Christian minister, said about Albert Camus, that if you read his work underneath his existentialism, you know he wants to be a believer. And I think what he meant was that, like, there was a part of him that had not lost all faith and still thought, you know what, maybe there's some more to life than just you live and die. So anyway, I'll be quiet now. So I, in the end of the day, didn't buy he was a doomster. I think this is his attempt to say, wait a minute, folks, it's worse than you think. We've got to change radically. So for me, I had a slightly different reaction to where I really felt he was coming from in his heart.
So, John, I think in part it depends on what you think is collapsing, what you think is dying. I think it's a lot easier to see what is dying than what's being born. Mm-hmm. And I think the consumer industrial society, where we have these long, complex supply chains, where we have, 9 billion people on the earth now living as if there's no tomorrow, separate from nature, better than nature. I actually think that is dying and needs to die. And I think he's pretty clear about that. I think the way that he's not a doomster and why your mother's hospice story isn't exactly on point is that something is being born here. This isn't the final story. It will be considerably less people, less consumption. And that if you're dependent on those long supply chains, if you're dependent on civil society and good government, and I'm just asking people to read the book and make their own conclusions. I'm not qualified to know how close we are to a methane release in Siberia or off the Siberian coast. But I generally agree with your analysis. And I think in the end, I found this actually a very positive book, the second half. And I think it's almost a spiritual book in terms of calling us back to the perennial wisdom that, frankly, greed is a problem. Kindness is better than meanness. Generosity is better than greed. Hubris is a fatal flaw. And I think we're about to find out.
Yeah, I was struck by some of his, you know, he spent time as Davos, as forget the role that he played there, but he was like awarded some
young diplomat, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And so he wasn't among the rich and powerful elite, but he was there with a voice, so to speak. And I've been to some of those kinds of gatherings where we eat shrimp cocktail and talk about how we're surely saving the world. And I think what I did really appreciate about those moments in the book was I think he pokes a very powerful hole in the narrative that we're anywhere near going in a radical enough direction to rethink things. That it's almost like, I spend a lot of time in the business sustainability circles. And I can tell you, it's the very rare business elite person who's talking about the fact that maybe our whole consumer industrial society has to change. It's really more, how can we reduce the amount it takes to live the way we live, right? And so I think he tries to, and successfully pokes a big hole in this idea that we can just kind of keep doing what we're doing and technology will save us. And a big hole in the fact that folks at that elite level are really having the kind of conversations that need to be had, that really tougher kind of conversation that you just mentioned, Jim.
Well, for example, he says the bright green future is a mirage. You know, like you said about electric cars, it's not going to be enough. Zero carbon is impossible. And even if you could do it, it wouldn't address the collapse in pollinators, the collapse of biosystems, the acidification of the ocean, the destruction of aquifers. So this, in the final analysis, this really isn't a book about climate change. It's a book about ecological overshoot. And I would invite your listeners, I don't know if you guys have read this yet, but a guy named William Catton II wrote a book called Overshoot in 1980. He was a local guy from Washington State University and the University of Washington. And I had a pretty good education in ecology, worked as a professional ecologist for many years, and I'd never heard of him. And I just read it recently at the recommendation of Michael Dowd. And it's a fundamental book. He really lays it out. I have some differences with him, but this is really about just demanding more resources and creating more waste than the system can afford. And that's pretty basic ecology. The conditions were right. When the conditions are right, life forms emerge, and when they're not, they disappear. A simpler way of thinking about collapse is just look at all the civilizations in history that rise and fall. And I think there's a lot of evidence now that we're on a pretty steep decline. And as a Western Europe, United States consumer society, unless some very radical changes can occur, it's going to be a tough ride. That's why I feel sad for the kids.
Yeah, and it's amazing. As you mentioned, Overshoot was written a number of years ago, and so was Limits to Growth, which was even before, and in the 70s, I think. So we've had these messages, these warnings, and not much has changed, or not enough has changed. And what strikes me in what Jim Bendel is saying is that we have actually been complicit, or we thought that the monetary systems we had put in place, or somebody put in place, would actually lead us to some good direction. He says, no, they cannot. And that's where he comes in with the freedom to act from the systems that we have put in place, which we relied on to reach a global industrial civilization. And initially, it was intriguing to me, what does he mean by freedom? Does he use freedom in the way some extreme right people are using it? No, it says that's it's a freedom to recover our capacity to act in the interest of the whole, nature included, and probably more local solutions than we have. And that means, for instance, what the local futures movement is about is also how can we move in a direction that relies less on larger systems and, as you said, very complicated and long supply chains to cultivate that capacity to fulfill our own needs, at least locally, and free ourselves from the way we have been brought up and educated over the last 50, 60, 70 years. And I was interested to, and he has a sentence saying, because as our systems break down, it threatens our old stories of self. So what must die too is the story we've been telling ourselves of what does it mean to be a citizen and what a worker in today's world. And that was actually, for me, very challenging for many of us to think who we are.
I think he takes dead aim at the American dream, which has been exported all over the world now. Notion that I'm making a better life for my kids, that I'm going to protect them, they're going to have more choices or fulfill more potential. He takes that on very directly. And I think the most interesting part of the book is the final thing where he talks about reimagining a future after looking into the abyss, and that we really need to figure out new ways of finding meaning, new narratives, like you said, Alon, new symbols. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had in the past month in preparing for this discussion where people just have layer upon layer of denial because it is too painful to look at.
My mind is firing in a lot of different directions. One of the directions is the tension, I think, between acceptance and resignation. So I accept myself that the odds of some level of societal collapse for humanity are probably now inevitable. I think it would be unfair to say it is inevitable. I think it probably is. The probabilities, you know, I'm a statistician by training earlier in my life. So, you know, the probabilities are that collapse of some significant portion is going to happen. The tension is, in my mind, so that might drive me to, as you said, Jim, and nothing wrong with that, to try to live a more local life, to be as disconnected from the supply chains, to grow my own food, to develop my own community, to do as Jim has done in Tacoma, have, you know, a big solar panel array so that I don't have to worry if the grid, and I could go on, right? And to be kind, you know, et cetera. And the tension on the other side of that is that it also can lead to resignation, which is, well, there's nothing we can do. So therefore, let's stop trying. And I think the challenge with that is that, you know, I was involved very early on in the kind of movement to slow or shrink human population. I was a delegate to the UN Conference on Population and Development in Cairo in 1994. Many billions of people ago, you know, the world was talking about how can we slow population growth. We did slow it, but it actually has accelerated. It's almost inevitable now. It'll eventually peak. And so the tension really that I feel as I think about this is, how do we accept the potential inevitability of some level of collapse while really staying in the game, for lack of a better way, to push for change? And we have small wins to point to. There just was a big report done by a scientist about the major systems of the Earth being in collapse, and they're all in the red zone. And he pointed out to something I pointed out, that one of the few successes of our lifetime, global successes, was the depletion of the ozone layer. It's the only one of his systems that's actually getting better. Now, the thing about the ozone layer is we only had to give up one set of products. It didn't require changing our whole way of living or the whole way we organize. So we were able to come together and do it. And the problem is that these things are all so linked now that it's overwhelming to imagine what to do. But I feel that tension around, can we do what Meg Wheatley and Jem are talking about, be local, be kind, build communities, and at the same time, not be in denial, but still be our hands on the plow, because I think we need to keep looking for solutions. And no doubt the solutions are deeper than the ones we're looking for. And maybe some level of collapse would require that. Frankly, the ozone layer thing didn't happen until NASA had images that were made it so obvious that the ozone hole might eventually go over the whole Earth, that leaders of the world said, you know, oh, holy crap, we better do something about it, and came together in Montreal and did it, right? Problem with this one is there won't be one easy fix. You just can't get rid of chlorofluorocarbons and fix the problem we're in now. So it's a very complex challenge that we're facing.
What I read from Bendel and Catton both is that overshoot is the more fundamental problem, and that the only solution to overshoot is massive de-development in the wealthy world. And I frankly can't think of any political party, communist, socialist, capitalist, you name it, who could possibly offer that as a point. Now, just to give an illustration from Bendel's book, he says that in 2020, global carbon emissions actually did fall 5%. Because of the COVID crisis. It had the effect of dislocating all sorts of things. As you recall, it, according to Bendel, it put 120 million people into extreme poverty, which is the greatest increase in extreme poverty, perhaps the only one in a generation. And he said for us to meet the Paris target, that 5% would have to happen 10 years in a row. Yeah. It's a very daunting challenge. Now let's put that with another factoid, which he says, Finn, you know, the last 15 or 20 years, I guess it was, that the average, the per capita footprint has increased of energy, carbon impact has grown 40%. So we're going exactly in the wrong direction. Despite all the solar panels on my house and in my region, despite the plummeting costs, they're not even making up for the increase in new carbon energy sources. So we're actually falling further behind because the demand is increasing so much. And part of that is very laudable. A lot of people have been pulled out of poverty. You know, the diet in China is infinitely better than it was a generation ago. And you can't blame those people for wanting more food or good food. Unfortunately, for many of us, that means destination weddings and overseas vacations and things that is just becoming the end of us, often with good people with good intentions. So it's quite a predicament.
It is a predicament, Jim, and the word degrowth is still a taboo word in political circles, because it just threatens. And of course, it's complex, as you said, because, you know, is it degrowth for just industrialized countries or heavily industrialized countries or all over the world? And what is the justice in that when some are still trying to emerge below the level of poverty? So that for me is a good application of what he says when we need to give up our narratives of what makes a good life. What can I actually do? And he has a very simple answer. It is disconcerting, is each of us put our inner house in order. You know, it's what can we do where we are? And probably the sacrifice is going to be steeper and deeper for people living in Western countries than in other countries, which are in a very different state of development. So it's probably why it's going to take so much for people to accept the fact that our children are not going to live the same type of life we've had, possibly a more simple life. But what kind of simple life?
So something like a supply chain sounds like kind of an abstract concept. But I would just invite the listeners to look about their home, look about their life, and think about where the things come from that they want or need. And I'm not talking about your favorite cheese at your local deli. You couldn't get cheap pork during COVID because of workers getting COVID. I'm talking about your heart medicine. I'm talking about when your glasses break. And I think those are the kind of supply chain breakdowns we're talking about. They're very precarious. Just to give you an example in the food area, which is pretty universal and close to home. He says since 2017, the majority of people in the world live in urban areas. I know in New York City, which I think is fairly typical, they have about a 4 or 5 day of supply of food, and that there's profound challenges to aquifers all over the world, either being drawn down or poisoned. And you talk about the breadbasket in Ukraine. It wouldn't take too much to imagine skyrocketing food prices or actually food shortages. Although, frankly, some of his conclusions are a little hard to swallow. When I walk about my town and can go to Costco and buy a big box of organic lettuce for $4 that came from Mexico, what's he talking about? It just seems hard to believe. But for some reason, I can't write him off as a crank. I've watched his videos. I've read this book very carefully. I read the earlier papers on deep adaptation. And for some reason, I just can't dismiss him. And maybe that's personal psychology. Who knows what it is? But I think he needs to be taken seriously.
Well, you know, it's no accident that Al Gore's film was named An Inconvenient Truth. So we're in denial about this in part because of how incredibly inconvenient it is to our daily lives. And it's human beings are pretty good at denial. All of us are in many realms of our life. And so there, no doubt there is a kind of collective denial about what's happening behind the Hollywood set of everything looks good. But to your points about degrowth, someone did try a degrowth politic and it didn't go so well for him. That was Jimmy Carter. Any of you old enough to remember Jimmy Carter? Mm-hmm. He did that famous malaise speech from the White House in his little cardigan sweater, and Ronald Reagan on an optimistic message about we can keep doing it forever better than anyone in the world, you know, swept and really changed the narrative of the country. Honestly, the Reagan Revolution was quite profound in America. Some of us think for the worse, some people think for the better. So many politicians have died on the degrowth sword. So instead, certainly true in the United States and Canada right now with President Biden and with Prime Minister Trudeau, massive investments in green energy and technology with the hope and instilling the belief for people that if we could only do that, make our houses more efficient, create more solar and wind, that we can just keep doing what we're doing. And then, well, if only India and China would do what they need to do. And as you guys have both pointed out, it's not just because they have dirtier energy, which they do on the whole, than the traditional developed world, but they also are bringing millions and millions of people out of poverty into the middle class, which itself has growth consequences in terms of impact on the planet. But I can just imagine some of our listeners, those who have hung in this long, because some have probably already turned it off and said, that is like too much for me. I think it's really important for us to say, so what? So what? So let's say those who have hung with us so far accept the fact that the three of us probably believe that the way we're going isn't working, that unless something radically changes, and it probably has to include a different definition of the good life, and it's going to have to be systemic. It's not going to be driven by individuals making changes. It's not going to be enough. So what? Someone might say, well, okay, guys, what do you want me to do? Because I'm listening to this podcast today. Should I not replace my furnace because it's not going to matter anyway? Not buy that Tesla because it's not going to change the world? Stop writing to my congressman because it doesn't matter what law they're passed. So I could easily see someone saying, well, so what, guys? So let's see if we can answer that question. Again, let's do it personally. First of all, like what did each of us, having read this book, how, if at all, has it changed what we think we want or ought to do? And I'll start with you, Jim.
Yeah, I would say this. I started reading Ben Dale more carefully about 6 months ago when I was in a conversation with a therapist friend of mine who's a dear friend. And at some point we were talking about climate change and he said, we're not going to do anything about climate change. And I was just outraged. I was personally offended because of what I've done and lived my life. And the more I thought about it and the more I looked into it, I thought that son of a gun is right. However, I don't think Ben Dale is saying, and I don't think I came to the conclusion that we should stay home and smoke pot or become nihilists because nothing matters. I think he's actually very passionate in this book, particularly the second part of the book where he talks about this is an opportunity to redefine who you are and who a good society is. And I think that, for example, the great resignation from COVID might be a sign of health, that people who are working at jobs they don't like to pay for mortgages they can't afford, you know, it might be a time to rethink your priorities. And I really appreciate his systemic analysis about why that is around money, power, and the way we've been duped. That the difference between he and Catton is that Catton blames it on human nature, that in some ways humans are no different than bacteria in a petri dish. We just overshoot, we grow too big, and then we crash. Sorry, that's the way it is. But he has a much more analytical analysis. And so I probably am less likely to spend time giving money to the Democrats. I'm more likely to spend time giving money, at least the National Democrats. I'm more likely to support my local food growing with underprivileged teenagers group or other local things that I see can make a difference working with the local climate action team. I think we need to find people to talk about this predicament with because it's a very isolating point of view. It's not a way to make yourself popular at a party, I'll tell you that, because people really don't want to hear it. But underneath it, I think there's an intuition that's being affirmed. That's what he says. He says the professional environmentalists are the people who have the hardest time with his message. But regular people will say, thank you for that language, because it's affirmed something I've intuited for a while. And I think in the final analysis, the real question is, do we turn to one another or do we turn on one another? And that's his breaking together or breaking apart. And in some ways, that will go to the question of what does it mean to be a human being, you know, when the chips are down. And I'm sure it'll be some of each. In America, at least, it's not real encouraging right now of our ability to solve hard problems or any problems. So you know, I have some things I'm doing in my own personal life, but that's probably enough for now.
Yeah, it does question the very individualistic perspective that we have, particularly in this country, but also in France, where I'm from. And I was interested by what Jem Bendel said about the dynamic between the youth that can sense that there is something basically wrong and the older people that still gaslighting other people by saying, oh, it's going to be okay. So for as an elder myself, I feel that I need to be able to tell the truth, not in an offensive way, but not just tell it, but show in my own behavior, the way I consume or not consume, that it is indeed up to every one of us to start behaving not just individually, differently, and knowing that degrowth is necessary, but also in solidarity with others. So that's why I'm very interested in what can happen at the community level. I mentioned local futures as an avenue in that dimension, saying, what can we do? And my wife, for instance, is trying to build a community of neighbors in Portland, where we live, so that people support each other even now, before times are difficult, but that there is a sense that we are in it all together and we each bring different gifts and different liabilities to the process. So that's the direction I'm going on myself. We're also creating a community of regenerative elders through some of the courses we've introduced, so that people have, because they have seeped themselves into this way of looking at the world, are willing to start acting on it in their own lives. And then, but they need others to support themselves because it's a difficult break. I can't see many people being able to do this on their own. They will need others to be either local or virtual communities while it's still possible. That's the direction in which I'm going myself.
And for me, thank you both for sharing that. Since I've only read the book in the last few weeks, I can't say it's profoundly shifted me at the moment. But two things strike me. One is that one of the points in the book that he makes that I don't agree with, the most profound disagreement I probably have with his book, is he kind of dismisses large actions by big entities like governments and businesses. He sort of says, no, if we're going to, the world's going to be saved, it's going to be saved from the local up in a way. And actually, as attractive as that idea is, like I loved Paul Hawkins' book, Blessed Unrest. And I believe that humans are herd animals and that just like there's no real leader of the or any herd animal, they all kind of get it. Enough people get it and they move. It's the 100th monkey kind of thing. But I think that the problems we face today are so large and complex that I feel it makes me, I do a lot of work at places like the Stimson Center and some folks, sustainable brands working on these big kind of levers. I still feel that I want my hands on that plow, because I do believe that the question of how big the collapse will be is still a very uncertain, in spite, no matter how you read his book, it sounds like large, significant collapse is inevitable in a short period of time, relatively short period of time. I don't think everyone agrees with that. Even some very reputable scientists across the world and folks who study this will say, well, we're going to go through hell in the next 20 or 30 years. We all know that, right? But the level of hell is still questionable. So I believe we need governments, we need big business to continue to really look at the system. And I believe that our job is to keep working on the consciousness of people and continue to work on leaders so that when the collapse becomes so obvious that action is required, the soil is ready for them to potentially take the kind of action and the population willing to accept the kind of action that's taken because we've prepared them. So honestly, it didn't, you know, I think I already have a pretty good local life. I think I could start growing food overnight if I had to. I've got a plot of land and stuff. So for me, I'm less worried about, I got to be ready so that when the collapse comes, like, that I'll be okay. Frankly, in some ways, I don't give a crap about that, right? If the whole thing's going to collapse, well, let me collapse with it. Let me lean into the collapse. So I guess for me, the big message for me was the whole system has to change. And we've got to stay pushing for that. We've got to keep that message going. So when collapse reaches the level of people go, holy smoke, something has to be done. And one thing we know about human beings is we're not very good proactively, but we sometimes are pretty good in a crisis to make a change when we've hit bottom. And so I still got to hold on to that. And I feel like it's my responsibility as an elder to keep doing that, because I don't share his, I guess, lack of faith that large institutions can make changes. And again, I've talked about this on the podcast before, but acid rain is a good example. Acid rain did not change because people started doing local farming in their garden. It happened because the public got tired of it. The media focused on it. Businesses and governments came together and said, you know, it's not too late to do something about it. And acid rain isn't in the headlines anymore. And the reason is because big institutions, with the support of the population, did something about it. So I haven't lost faith in that, though I do believe he's right. The collapse is coming more quickly and more systemically than most people believe. And that the way governments and business are progressing now without really looking at the deeper changes is not enough. So I say we gotta find a way to accelerate that, because I don't think it's too late for us to have less of a collapse, not only for ourselves, but for other species. I'm a spiritual person. I believe the whole thing is sacred. I know you guys share that. I'm also concerned that we minimize the damage we do to all the rest of life. And I'm not ready to give up on that and retreat. And I'm not saying you guys are doing that, but it didn't make me retreat. It made me say, double down, man. And in the meantime, be spiritually ready for what might be coming.
Now, likewise, although I must admit I'm often disappointed in my species, I'm not ready to give up on the human experiment. I think we have remarkable capacities. I do think the world we'll be living in will be substantially changed, and maybe for the better. But I just wanted to say a word before we close about why I think this might resonate with your elder audience. At least in my journey to eldership, I'm 71, so I'm a younger elder, but I'm an elder for sure, has been about letting go of control and mastery, living more in the present, in the mystery of can't know, don't know, and being more generous with what we have been given, or more poetically, what we have and what we have left. And I think that's really what Bendel is saying, is no matter how much time and how much resilience there is, is fine wisdom in that, and generosity and kindness. And I agree that, you know, top down, bottom up, both got to happen.
Yes, it would be, I sense, a combination of both, a lot of bottom up and initiatives bottom up also linking to one another. And that's what some are doing across the world, not just in one country. And it will, as you said, John, possibly then influence the way governments act. The rules of the game have to change quite a bit, though, at the top level, so that it is okay to talk about degrowth again. So will there be some, quote, providential men that will be able to speak that language and get enough support from a minority of the population so that that could change? That's a question. So I don't give up on the possibility of larger organizations, including governments, to do something. But they will need a lot more prodding that they are getting now from people like us and citizens generally in order to change their way of thinking and their way of speaking.
Yeah, and you know, when Alon said providential men, he meant providential mankind. So we've said on a previous podcast, if women were running the world, we probably wouldn't be in such a this level of mess we're in right now. One of the things, as you were speaking, Alon, I was thinking that on the one hand, the actions that we take are a kind of of spiritual journey for ourselves. And I think that to me, the book and books like it first say, don't live in denial. And I think the first step of growth, of change, is to give up the denial that we're all living in, that this party can just keep going the way that it's going. And as you said, Alon, we're not really looking at the big stuff yet. And we're going to have to. And that's like any even individual human life. That's the hard stuff, really, to really look at the system itself and examine it. And I do think there are a lot of younger people around the world who really do think the system itself needs to be changed. And of course, as Bendel says in his book, the problem with the system changing is the people who run the system benefited from it. They don't really want the system to change. So that's kind of what we're up against, but we have to stay with it. I can't help but think of one of the things that Bendel said towards the end of his book. I'll just read this quote. He said, "I hope future generations may remember that we weren't all so dumb." In that spirit of recognizing our elders, I will close with the words of E.F. Schumacher, used to close his own book 50 years ago, and he spoke profoundly about his respect for Schumacher's work. And Schumacher said 50 years before I wrote my book, "Everywhere people ask, what can I actually do? The answer is as simple as it is disconcerting. We can each of us put our own inner house in order. The guidance we need for this work cannot be found in science or technology, the value of which utterly depends on the ends they serve. But it can still be found in the traditional wisdom of humankind." And it makes me think to myself that this is, in the end, a spiritual problem, spiritual challenge. And I encourage people to read the book, because I think it will perhaps lead to a kind of spiritual awakening for you around this moment that we're in, and Mig Wheatley's book as well. So who do we choose to be? So great conversation, folks. And we didn't solve it, but we didn't think we would. But we're in a very unique moment in human history that requires a deep reckoning inside and in the system. So, Jim, thank you for being our guest. We'll give you a chance for a final word. Anything you want to say before we close?
I think of the German philosopher Joseph Schopenhauer, who said that all deep truth is first ignored, then ridiculed, and then determined to be self-evident. And I think this is one of those things that in 5 or 10 years could be self-evident to a lot of people.
And Alon, you?
I love that quote that you said, mentioned, Jim. I do agree with you that it is a spiritual issue, basically, in the sense of what's the meaning of life and what is the meaning of my life at this time. And how do I feel one with all of there is, including nature, so that I don't dissociate my fate from other people and nature itself. So I think this is a good opportunity for reflection. And yes, it's a difficult read, but it's a very worthwhile read.
I'll just say thank you both. It was a good conversation.
Yeah. Now, one final thought is we hope that today we have not taken away your hope, but perhaps stimulated within you some deep reflection about this moment that we are in, the part that you want to play, and maybe the part that each one of us is going to play as we deal with the inevitable challenges that are coming for us and our communities in the years ahead. So finally, I want to thank you, our listeners. You're the reason we exist. As we always say, if you like what you heard today or appreciated it, please share it with others and let us know. If you like what you heard but think there are other topics or guests that we should have, we'd love to hear from you. And remember, as one of our previous guests said, history is not a future moment waiting for us to arrive. History is what we will create that will be the moment we will arrive in one day. So thank you again. We'll see you next time on The Way Forward.
I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to our podcast, The Way Forward Regenerative Conversations. You have many choices, and we appreciate your interest and support. You can reach us at our email address, thewayforwardrc@gmail.com. Please share your thoughts and feedback with us. Only with your help can we make this a podcast you want to listen to and share with your friends. If you have guests you would like us to have a conversation with, please email us your recommendations. I would also like to thank our sponsor, Elders Action Network, who is building a movement of elders to address the environmental, governance, and social issues of our time. Their website is eldersaction.org. Until next time, I'm Jim Burke, and this is the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast, which you can listen to on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, and Amazon Music. In parting, may I wish you a regenerative present and future.